Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fundamentals Podcast. I'm your host, Harley. Joining me today is the other half of the Ramblin' and Amblin' podcast, Joshua Glenn. Josh was kind enough to give me some of his time to talk about a series of films that are incredibly close to his heart, and that is the Matrix films. We cover everything from the groundbreaking introduction that was the first film to the much maligned and perhaps misunderstood sequels. There's so much that we get into in this conversation, and I really hope you guys enjoy it. So without further ado, let's get to the conversation. This is The Matrix with Joshua Glenn. Hello, Josh, and welcome to the Fundamentals Podcast.
Hello, thank you very much for having me on. It's nice to be here.
Oh, pleasure's all mine. So when we started chatting, you threw out a few ideas, and one that jumped out was, I say, arguably one of the most influential sort of sci-fi series we've had probably ever, but certainly in the modern era, and that is the Matrix trilogy, soon to be a quadrilogy, depending on how things go. So before we get to any of that, I'd love to know from your story, really, how did you sort of stumble across the Matrix? What's your journey with the series?
I remember way back in the summer of 1999 when I was a wee lad, a little nipper, and Star Wars Phantom Menace was the big summer blockbuster of that year. And I don't know if you remember, but there was so much merchandise across the board. It was dominating the whole conversation, it seemed, for a young lad of six or however old I was back then. But then there was this kind of, certainly within my limited worldview, there was this alternative take that the hot summer film was not Star Wars, but in fact this little thing called The Matrix. Remember, I had a cousin who I looked up to an awful lot, who was a couple of years older than I was, and he was plugged into the cool things in a way that I, as such a young boy, wasn't aware of. And he had got a pirate copy VHS of The Matrix and said, yeah, this Star Wars thing, yeah, it's all right, but look, the cool thing at the minute is this thing, The Matrix. And of course, I wasn't allowed to watch it yet because it was a 15 film and my parents were quite strict in terms of what I could watch for a while. But I was aware of it as this cool alternative sort of, to me, underground version of Star Wars. So for a couple of years after that, it was a forbidden fruit to me. I'd see little clips here and there. I had an uncle who was very much into martial arts movies, and he showed us the clip of Morpheus and Neo fighting in the dojo. And I thought, oh, God, what I would give to see this movie. And then finally, I think my parents allowed me to rent it on video. Remember back in the old days of video? I sound like an old fart. I'm not that old, but you know, I was sort of just at the cutoff point of things not quite being on demand. And I finally rented it and I watched it, and I must have been around about 10, so still a bit too young to really get the most out of the philosophical undertones of the whole thing, but old enough to find the visual side of things and the world building very, very cool. And I think it's one of those things. It's one of the first DVDs that I bought once we all, you know, switched over to DVD, and it's one that I revisited an awful lot. And there was just something so beguiling and mysterious about it. It invited you in. It made you really work to tease out the answers. And for a young sort of budding movie nerd that I was, it was a really exciting thing to cut on to. And then, of course, the sequels came out eventually, which were much maligned. But increasingly over the years, one of the cultural hills that I will die on, and one of the reasons that I'm here today with you talking about this, is that I think the sequels are much, 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 much better than the reputation allows for, suggests that they are. And that's a stance that I've come to over time and with quite a bit of work. But we'll get to that, I'm sure,
over the course of this. Absolutely, we will. But no, I love that intro because I think we must be a similar age then. Because at time of recording, I am 26. So how old would you be?
28.
Well, there you go. So yeah, I was that very similar, actually, in terms of that. I totally agree. I was that prime age for The Phantom Menace and all of that. That was my entry into that world, which keeps coming up on this show, and I think we will be covered at some point, I promise. But but yeah, like yourself, I remember hearing about it, about this sort of crazy sci-fi kung fu movie. And, and same thing, I was way too young. But yeah, as I got into my teens, it was like, oh yeah, I remember hearing about this film, and I've heard bits and pieces of it, and friends had recanted it to me, he'd seen it. So yeah, finally sitting down and watching it, and probably the same way. Yeah, I didn't fully get all the sort of deeper parts of it, but it was like, oh, this is really cool. This is this crazy action movie and sci-fi, and I was really into all of that. But yeah, like, you're absolutely right. I think that first film certainly opened up a generation, didn't it, of sort of film lovers and kind of blending these weird worlds together of sort of, you're very, I guess, what you'd expect from your sort of Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan kind of movies, to then bringing it into AI and all this sort of other stuff. So am I right in thinking it's all based on like a source material, isn't it?
Well, it's kind of a, much like Star Wars kind of synthesized early 20th century form. So it took Westerns and by extension samurai films and all those fairy tales and Joseph Campbell's hero's myth, and it synthesized them into this weird new kind of blockbuster. I think The Matrix does a very similar thing to the second half of the 20th century. So it takes these martial arts films, it takes cyberpunk and anime and film noir, and it weaves them into this weird new thing. But it was an original concept from the Wachowskis. It wasn't based on a particular existing property. It was an original, I suppose. You could definitely, I mean, Ghost in the Shell is very much a ground zero. Akira is something that is very much part of its lineage. And then by extension, like dystopian films, like obviously Blade Runner, for any dystopian film, Blade Runner is a huge reference point. But there was nothing, it wasn't based on an existing graphic novel or anything. It was born of the Wachowskis' weird disparate interests.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I don't know why. I thought it was based on a comic or something, but that's incredible. Even more reason, yeah. I think, to get into it then. So sort of going from there then, talk about the first one. So it had such a massive cultural impact, didn't it, sort of straight out of the gate. So it was the sort of turn of the century. Do you think things like what's it called, the sort of Millennium Bug and stuff like that, all this kind of interest around technology, it sort
definitely
of helped it kind of get this reputation?
I think so. Out of the gate, I must admit that I'm a huge, huge fan of the Wachowskis. And I know their films have received varying responses from people, and there are people that like different films in their filmography and dislike other ones. I love what they do, and I love how they create their own mythologies, or they will adapt something and put their own unique spin on it. And sometimes that thing correlates with the zeitgeist, like The Matrix did, and sometimes it doesn't. But with The Matrix, it was a passion project they'd been gestating on for a while, and it just happened to come. It was a perfect aligning of stars, because they'd signed a 3-screenplay deal with Warner Brothers, in which they sold Assassins, Bound, and The Matrix, and they wanted to direct The Matrix, but because they didn't have experience with something that big, they had to make something else beforehand to kind of prove they could handle it. So they made Bound. Have you seen Bound?
I don't think I have, no.
Their first film, it's Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon, and it's this really steamy kind of erotic thriller with a very, very Hitchcockian take. It's kind of like how Chris Nolan made Memento, this really shoestring, small-scale noir before blowing up and just taking over Hollywood, making these huge visions. And the Wachowskis did a very similar thing. They made Bound, this really small, self-contained noir, and they kind of proved that they could handle filmmaking, and they could do an awful lot with not very much. And that allowed them to be in a position in the late 90s. I think it was early 98 that Matrix started filming. So it was very much, they had got themselves into a position where they could make this film and allow it to be released at a time when, like you say, the Millennium Bug paranoia and Y2K and all that business was very much in the peak of people's consciousness. So it was a perfect aligning of stars for this film to really come out and dominate the conversation like it did.
Yeah, I think that's incredible. And I'd love to know. So yeah, sort of talk to me a bit more about their side of it then. Like, have they ever revealed what it was that kind of, I guess, push them in the direction of this story? Because it's quite a interesting concept, you know, the core idea of the film.
Yeah. I mean, there are many readings, and when we get onto the sequels, I can sort of delve into what I think the whole series is about. But I think that certainly looking at the Wachowskis and their personal experiences since the film, they since came out as trans, and they are now Lily and Lana Wachowski. And I think you can definitely view this film as, and you can pretty much view all their films as allegories for the personality and, in a more spiritual sense, the soul not being bound to a particular human form. So the body you're born into, in a sense, is not who you are necessarily, you know. And the Matrix is all, like, the big tagline was free your mind. And I think sort of knowing what they were, sort of knowing the these feelings and things that were going on that they hadn't yet revealed to the world, I think it very much, this film works as an allegory for sort of coming out and for allowing yourself to be who you want to be and that kind of thing. So I suspect, it's not my place as a cis man to psychoanalyze, you know, these folks, but I think certainly that must have been at play, because you can very much read that thread throughout a lot of their films, similar ideas. I mean, look at Cloud Atlas, for instance. That's all about how the same spirit lives on through various different bodies over the course of thousands of years. But beyond that, in terms of sort of the extreme genre exercise that it is, I think it is just these extreme, passionate, proud nerds that they were, wanting to take all these things they loved, kind of like Edgar Wright does at the moment. He kind of makes the kind of film, and Tarantino as well, they make the kind of films they would like to watch. I think the Wachowskis, they had this really fertile creative period before they really hit pay dirt in the mid-late 90s, where they churned out a load of great concepts and great scripts. And this was the one, their sort of magnum opus at the time. They poured all of their passions and all their interests into it. And you can see, like, when you watch it from the very, very first frame, just the passion and the excitement is just pouring out of it, you know.
Absolutely, because it's... I think I loved it because, yeah, the concept of the idea of it sort of a post-apocalyptic film before those became just, you know, run-of-the-mill and everyone was doing them, and every sort of teen novel writer decided to use that as a backdrop for love triangles. Yes. You know, we actually got an interesting concept.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I rewatched it in the cinema, I think, just over 2 years ago. It had its 20-year anniversary.
Yes, of course it did, yeah.
And it still holds up. I was amazed watching it in the big screen, thinking, like, wow, this is incredible. I kind of felt like watching it for the first time, and, you know, it has this massive scope, and I think, as you say, the stars aligned. I mean, the fact they got the casting that they did, Keanu Reeves, sort of in the 90s, was really at his peak, and he's had a bit of a renaissance in the last few years, but I think probably getting people like him on board would have been a bit of stroke of luck for them, and sort of just help them line things up. And what you said a minute ago about the passion, I remember this actually, because I remember watching the behind the scenes DVD, and they were very concerned about lots of different aspects of the movie. So, like, the cast famously trained, didn't they, for like 8 or 9 months in a dojo.
It was a long time.
And you know, they didn't want to use stunt doubles where they didn't have to, which is sort of nowadays we think of, you know, some other films you might think, oh yeah, that's commonplace, but actually a lot of stunt teams nowadays are so good you wouldn't even notice they swap them out.
But
back then they were like, nope, we want cast front and center.
These folks to do their things, yeah.
And even stuff, there's a bit where I think a really awesome shot where a helicopter crashes into a building, and then there's like a huge explosion of glass, and Trinity's like flying through the air, and it's a great shot. But they talked about it, and they spent, I think, something like a couple of months researching different types of glass, what would break a certain way and what would look. I just remember, like, that stays with me, because I'm like, that's incredible dedication to your craft. And I feel like it's a mixture of all of those things and what you said that kind of made it such a smash hit, the way that it was. And, you know, it's gone on to have an amazing impact on pop culture, and probably did a real good number for people selling trench coats, I imagine, as well, and sunglasses.
And sunglasses, you know?
So, but yeah, we can definitely come back to some of the stuff there.
Yeah.
But I'd love to know then, because you've already mentioned it, and I think it's well worth talking about. Yeah, the sequels.
The sequels.
And I agree with you for the most part, actually. I've always felt this. I've always thought that when you watch them together, it's actually all right. You know, that you can see the whole story arc and the picture and everything they're trying.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not as well constructed as the first one or well paced, whatever. But yeah, I believe they work well. So I'd love to know from your point of view, yeah, what is it that makes you want to die on this hill?
I love dying on a hill like this. For a long time, I've always thought that the sequels were deeply flawed, interesting, kind of admirable failures. And then it was only watching them, I showed them my girlfriend at the start of lockdown, and I just, like, suddenly everything clicked, and I thought, oh no, these films genuinely are great. What they're going for, it's really interesting. So I mentioned previously how Star Wars is very much a work through of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, and The Matrix is very much in the same, along the same path. It's your classic hero's journey. It works as a Christ metaphor, that kind of thing. It's kind of like the perfect example of a hero's journey. And I think the sequels, on first viewing, it's not immediately apparent what they're doing, because it's obfuscated an awful lot by impenetrable dialogue, and very, very almost exhausting, an exhausting procession of action sequences. And after, I think, on first viewing, maybe second viewing, third viewing as well, you are kind of battered into submission, and you are unable to connect with it in the same way as you are the first one, because it doesn't have the same advantage the first one did. And it's not apparent what it's doing. But what I kind of cottoned onto, the crux of what the sequels are doing, is kind of dismantling everything the first one does so well. So the first one, like I said, is a perfect hero's journey. And the second one, very, very stubbornly and staunchly, its climax is built around a refutation of that. So, you know, if you can remember, the whole second film is building towards Neo getting to the source of the machines and turning it off and saving Zion, which is humanity's final stand in the real world, saving Zion from annihilation by these machines. So the entire film, you're primed for this epic confrontation between Neo, the One, and his destiny, which is turning off the machines and saving humanity. And what you actually get, instead, he gets to the source, he opens his door, and you've got this Colonel Sanders-looking gentleman in a white suit sitting in front of a bunch of screens, waxing lyrical for what feels like half an hour, but in reality is about maybe 8-9 minutes. just you sounding like he's swallowed a thesaurus and is vomiting at the audience. And
vis-a-vis Ergo. Yeah.
Vis-a-vis concordantly. and it's such a rug pull in terms of the climax of a summer blockbuster, because it came out in March, in May, and then the third one came out in November of the same year, 2003. And it's so antithetical to what you expect the climax of a film like this to be, that it was ripe for parody at the time. I remember there was an MTV Movie Awards parody of it with Sean William Scott and Justin Timberlake, with Will Ferrell playing the architect, which I return to quite a bit. I find that probably funnier than I should. it's one of those things where at face value, it's ridiculous. But the more you kind of burrow into what he's saying, and the more you think about that in the context of what you've seen, what he's essentially saying to Neo is, you aren't the first person to be, you aren't the first one, you're not the first sort of savior. What you are is a kill switch, essentially. So this whole thing about human beings being freed and launching a resistance, and the machines coming towards the city, and the one being freed, and the one who is destined to save humanity, this is all preordained. This is all part of our system. And what we do when your predecessors, because Neo's version of the One is the sixth iteration of the One since the beginning of the Matrix. And the architect kind of says to him, what your predecessors do is they return to the source, they reset the Matrix, they pick 100 or so survivors to repopulate Zion, begin again, and the Matrix kind of starts from year zero. And then this whole, you know, hundreds, thousands of years cycle continues until the seventh version of the One comes along and does the same thing again. And that is such a, I think, because it's so flying in the face of what the first one does. The first one is presents it as, oh, this is a unique new thing that's happening, and the sequel just says, no, it's not. This is, you've seen this thing over and over and over again, and it's part of this ongoing cycle of the same old hero's journey. And that, I just find that so bold. I love that as a notion. I love that as an idea. But the difference being this time around is that Neo's version of the One, he refuses to do what his predecessors do. He instead decides to leave, not go to the Source, not reset the Matrix, but instead fly and save Trinity, who is his lover, who he sees as the most important thing in the world to him. And in doing so, he sets humanity on this path to ultimate freedom from this preordained cycle of machine control. And I just think on a macro level, that kind of story structure, it is kind of the series having its cake and eating it too, because the first Matrix, I think, is a perfect movie. It's one of my all-time favourites. And I think it clearly is the best of all three of these movies. But if you are going to have a sequel to a film like that that doesn't necessarily call out for a sequel, this is kind of the best way I think you can do that. It enhances and deepens the mythology of the first one. It pokes at these corners of the world, and it also plugs it into this larger narrative conversation about the limits of control and what freedom actually is and what free will actually is, and what we do with these stories that are given to us. And I just find that fascinating. I really love that as an idea. And then once Neo's been set on that path, the third one is him forging a new path to establish this ultimate freedom from this existing cycle of control. I mean, that's a kind of very, very intellectualized reading of the whole thing. I think on a sensory level, there's some really cool action beats in these movies. And I think the first one benefits from being something that is so new. And do you remember the advertising campaign for the first one? It was all very mystery box, and it kind of, I think the main thing was, what is the Matrix? People were lured in with very little information.
Because that kind of passed me by, but I've seen some like sort of retroactive look backs at it. I've seen like the posters and some clips, and is like an advert where somebody answers a phone and it's something like that, where it's like, you know, what's the Matrix, and it's this whole sort of viral campaign, which you don't really see anymore. So I think it must have worked really well.
I suppose the nearest thing you get is Chris Nolan's films. They're allowed, they kind of get by on the size of his name. But the first Matrix very much gets by on the thrill of the new. Like, the whole thing is, it lures you in with this tantalizing mystery. What is the Matrix? And then I think it's either at the very start or the very end of the Matrix. Oh, it's at the very end of the Matrix when Neo says, I'm going to show these people something you don't want them to see, that kind of thing. And the idea is, the Wachowskis want to show us, the audience, something fresh and something new with all these elements that have defined pop culture for the past, half century. I think the sequels, they don't quite have that same fresh out of the box feel, so it's not immediately apparent how exciting they are. But watching them again, I was really struck by how ballsy and how well fleshed out a lot of the action set pieces are in the sequels.
Yeah. No, I agree with a lot of what you said. Mm. And I've thought about this for years, that I think what you said earlier is true. Like, perhaps the packaging that it comes in puts a lot of people off, because, I mean, like, the freeway chase is incredible. And the fact that they, when you learn that they built that thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fit in it, like, some of the stuff they put in there was incredible. But it's one of those movies, I think both of them could do with a better sound mixing, which, in fairness, there are still people today, I'm looking at you, Christopher Nolan, that need to learn from this. So I kind of let it go, because I'm like, well, they're not the first, they won't be the last. Yeah. Be a much more stripped down script, especially at those core moments. Like you said, I was talking to somebody the other day, funny enough, about that exact scene with the architects.
Yeah.
And we were saying this, like, if you just strip away all the the weird choices of words and the mumbling, what's actually at the core of what he's saying is quite interesting. And it's a great twist.
Yeah,
but it gets lost in this minutiae and this bizarre performance. And then I think probably the third thing is, you could just edit down a lot of it. You could, there's certain scenes and action beats where you're like, you could probably just cut this out. and if they'd streamlined it a bit better, then yeah, perhaps it would have been more, you know, perhaps better received. But I like the point that you've just made that, yeah, it was a kind of an underground hit in a way. It's like an indie hit. Like, no one's expecting this to do really well, but it did. Smash hit, you know, huge cultural sensation. And yeah, the idea that, okay, there must be a sequel.
Mm.
And so there is one a couple of years later, and they do a two-parter in the same year.
Yeah.
And then the narrative that they go with is, yeah, the complete opposite to what you would expect. Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's something actually quite genius about that.
Yeah, it's ballsy, isn't it? It's just audacious. Mm.
Yeah, and I think, again, perhaps if they just maybe tweak some of it and made it a little bit more accessible to people, then maybe it would have hit. But then again, I agree with you. I think that the first Matrix in particular, all of them really, are high concept sci-fi movies.
Yeah.
And the thing with high concept films is, and this isn't to be, you know, dismissive of people's intelligence or anything, but some people just don't like them.
Mm.
Like, you know, I personally am a huge fan of Nolan films, you know, like The Prestige, Inception, stuff like that, which, yeah, the same sort of thing. Like, they're not actually terribly complicated at the core once you understand what's going on, but some people just don't like it. Some people just want big action film. And I think because the first Matrix has all of that to offer, like, you can just enjoy it on a surface level.
Yeah.
You know, bells and whistles, cool action scenes. Yeah, okay, I sort of get the concept, that's fine. And like you say, the sequels then go, well, hold on, we're going to really dive into the mythology and all the crazy stuff in this world. And yeah, surprise, this is one of six. It's, you know, things like that. Yeah, exactly. Suddenly you're like, wait, what?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're either like yourself or me, are either going to tune in and go, okay, tell me more, or you're going to go, I'm lost, what's happening? You know? are they fighting yet? Oh, they're not. Okay, he's still talking. So I can kind of understand that. And if someone listening to this feels that way, that's fine. But Josh, straight away, I think you've done an amazing job of explaining what's probably put a lot of people off in the first place.
Mm. I can understand. I really can understand. I think the Nolan comparison, I think, is brilliant, because take Inception, for instance. That film, there's an awful lot of exposition in that film. The first two thirds are kind of explaining the rules, and then the final third can kind of just do its thing, and you can just, by that point, you know what everyone is doing. They don't have to stop and explain it. You can just enjoy the sort of the cinematic quality of it. I think the first Matrix does a similar thing. It lures you in with this tantalizing mystery, and then it slowly fleshes out the rules of this world. So for the final hour of the first Matrix, it is just like all-timer of an action sequence after all-timer of an action sequence. And you already know by this point how they can do what they do. You know the stakes, you know sort of the flesh and bone of this world. And it's so that kind of that structure of a blockbuster, explaining the rules to allow the finale to just be purely cinematic with no need to explain these things anymore, that's a really fair trade-off, and the audience understands that bargain. I think they kind of get it. But then if to continue the Nolan analog, the Matrix sequels are similar to Tenet in that they don't, it's not the same deal you've got. So you go in expecting to be sort of shown around before everything cuts loose, but instead you have to just keep up from the start, and you have to do your homework, and you can't just sit there and be entertained. I think you do have to work at it if you want to avoid being frustrated by it. And you're right, that is, you know, for a lot of folks, off-putting for a blockbuster. I mean, when I first watched them, certainly I thought, oh, what is this? I'm not into this. This is weird. This is lame. No, thank you. But, you know, over time, I don't know, there's just something beguiling about them, I think, and I wanted to get to the bottom of them. I think it also helped that back in the mid to late noughties, there was this big bumper Ultimate Matrix collection box set that came out, and that was very much when I was in the peak of my collector's edition DVD mania. So I got that, and I watched the sequels over and over again and just delved into them and wanted to eke out the meaning and figure out what was going on. And a friend of mine called it Stockholm Syndrome, but I think it is just... Which I understand. No, I really like... I think you're right. I think the relationship this film establishes is different to the first Matrix film, and it's off-putting initially. And the packaging, like you say, the packaging it comes in, it's not very appealing. But if you are willing to work with that and to say, okay, so I'm not going to get the same thing again, this is something new. If you go with it and if you do work at it, there's a lot of great stuff under there to decipher. It just kind of, I don't know, it sort of succeeds sometimes in spite of itself. It's not dissimilar to the prequels. The prequels have a really great, the Star Wars prequels have a really great narrative underpinning them all. And that was something I thought about suggesting to do on this podcast, the Star Wars prequels. I think George Lucas sometimes falls over himself because he's unable to really express it in the best possible way. Whereas the Matrix sequels, I think the Wachowskis tell the story in a better way. There's just so much stuff that it's overwhelming and you're not quite sure where to focus. And as a result, you're overwhelmed and I think it can leave you dissatisfied. And, you know, most people are confused. No one likes being confused watching a film, certainly if they think that they're being cheated out of a satisfying narrative. You know, it's about the agreement that the film makes with you going in. You want to be clear on the terms of what you're about to watch. And I think narratively, the second film in the Matrix trilogy spits in the face of what the first one does in a way. It's dismantling of that. But how it's operating as a blockbuster is different to what you might expect coming in off the back of the first one, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, when you see most action movies today, they are kind of usually a very, very simple concept, story, whatever.
Mm.
It's very rare that you get something that then has a high sort of concept thing in the middle of it that's rooted in science fiction and mythology and archetypes and so much more.
So I
kind of think in a way of a weird analogy, it would be like you listen, you know, you get someone who brings out, I don't know, like a pop rock record and it's really mass appeal, you know, nice and simple, everybody loves it, millions of copies sold, and then their next album they go, okay, here's my progressive jazz funk album. And everyone's like, what? and you're gonna get a core group of people who are gonna go, well, actually, you know, there's something in here, and you know, and maybe people who understand music or just appreciate that.
Yeah.
I think, and again, this isn't being disparaging, it's just a fact that a large chunk of that audience is gonna go, yeah, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's fine. And again, that's fine. But I agree with you. So I think sticking with this then, looking at them as a package.
Yes.
You've mentioned it already, that the hero's journey, the archetype, the character of Neo, I think is a really fascinating one. And I think you're right that there's something to be learned about, that sort of studying the typical hero's journey. And I kind of touched upon this a little bit with a previous guest I had, Tony Black. He's written a whole book on mythology and the myth arc, and it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And there's lots of stories that do this, where they kind of take the familiar and then go, let's just tweak it, let's do something different. So sort of from the beginning then, what do you think about the character of Neo or Mr. Anderson, as he's often referred to?
Mr. Anderson. Well,
you can't help it.
You can't, no. Hugo Weaving just has such a relish in delivering those lines. Mr. Anderson. I love Neo. I think originally the Wachowskis approached Will Smith to play him. Had you heard that?
Yeah.
Will Smith apparently didn't understand he couldn't get his head around it and instead went for Wild Wild West.
That worked out well.
So they ended up with Keanu Reeves, who I think is just perfect casting, because in the first movie he plays this hacker character who dreams of there being something more. He's dissatisfied with what he's fed to him. He's got a boring corporate job. The world is very, very drab and sort of moldy green, and he wants there to be something else to give his boring plight meaning, and he's seeking out answers. He's seeking out this character called Morpheus, who will be able to tell him what he wants to hear. And of course, he does find Morpheus, and he does tell him what he wants to hear, that there is more than you see. What this is, all this around you, this is not reality. This is the wool that's been pulled over your eyes. And then the whole blue pill, red pill thing comes out, and he follows Rabbit down the hole and sees how deep the hole goes and wakes up in the real world. And I think Keanu Reeves is an easy enough fella to take the mickey out of because he can be perceived as being quite wooden. And sometimes he is horribly miscast. Sometimes he's not. Like, pretty much any period piece, Keanu Reeves is strange casting. But I think in this film, he is literally, he's a blank slate, isn't he? When he wakes up in the real world, he's never used his eyes before. He's never physically moved in that space before. And he is, I suppose, for all intents and purposes, he's the audience surrogate into that film. He is the one to whom all the information about the world is fed to. And he's our eyes and ears in that world. So I think, I really like Keanu Reeves. He isn't the best actor of all time, but I think he's pretty perfect for this role. And he brings an awful lot to it. And it's just perfect casting, because the whole thing exists in a heightened register. It's not going for naturalism, it's going for this heightened, almost self-aware sort of pop culture register. And then obviously he goes on in certainly in the first film to fulfill the basic hero's journey. He refuses the call. He then picks up the call again, and he proves himself to be who he was destined to be. What I think is most interesting about the character of John Anderson or Neo or the One is that as he exists kind of in his base form, he isn't really, he is part of the machine's overall plan. As was revealed by the architect in the second one, the One is not, there's no such thing as the One, but the One is kind of a kill switch, basically. So it's not really him, at least at the start, it's not really him who has the agency, and he isn't really the one who brings about, sets in motion the events that are going to bring about change. What actually happens is the Oracle is the one who feeds in a little bit of information that sets this cycle of machine control slightly off kilter. So when Neo makes the choice at the end of Reloaded to save Trinity as opposed to restarting the Matrix, that is because the Oracle told Trinity that her destiny was to fall in love with the One, and that then established a more localized form of love with the One that none of his predecessors had. The previous five Ones didn't have a love interest. They were kind of this virtuous, virginal Jesus Christ type. So when it came to the meeting with the architect, they could quite easily say, okay, we'll reset the Matrix, take some survivors essentially on an arc and repopulate the real world. Because Neo felt that one-to-one intimacy with Trinity, he was able to eschew that decision and take human course in a whole new direction. And it is that decision that sets up everything in the third film. So the point of him going to the source in Reloaded is to avoid the War of Zion, because there's going to be huge casualties and nobody wants that. They want to try and nip that in the bud. That was never on the table, as is revealed by the architect. It's either reboot the Matrix, pick some survivors and sort of start a new Zion, or go and save Trinity and the machines are going to wipe out the last human city. Neo takes a second option, but instead tries to broker a deal with the machines to establish a new status quo, essentially. So all of it is a long-winded way of saying that the hero's journey that is presented to us in the first film is not the ultimate hero's journey of the series. The macro theme of the film is kind of rejecting this idea of freedom that is fed to us from existing power structures and deciding for yourself what freedom is based on your own idea of self-actualization, which very much fits with what the Wachowskis will have been going through at the time in terms of their later coming out. But it also works in the context of Hollywood blockbusters as a kind of refutation of prepackaged stories with, like you say, just slightly tweaked elements here and there. And it kind of makes the argument for being a bit ballsier in your storytelling and a bit more ambitious in what you want. So ultimately, in his original hero's journey form, I think Neo is, he's kind of a pawn that the Oracle moves into place. But once he makes that decision at the end of the second film, he's able to become something new in the third film. He's able to become a new version of the One and bring about this new status quo for the human-machine relationship.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I love that insight. And it's something I've always thought was fascinating about his character is the theme of choice.
Yes.
It's something that is extremely embedded within the character. As you say, like for the first sort of one and a half parts of the films, really, he doesn't have a lot of agency, as you say. And that kind of absolute bomb drop of, you know, well, actually everything you've done up to now is just part of a program, as part of a system, you know, we're machines, this is what we do, this is what you do. So then choosing to go in another direction because of human emotions like love and faith and all this stuff, it's quite deep, I think. It's quite beautiful in a way.
Yeah, completely, you know, agree.
And then I love the whole final showdown with him and Smith, you know, like wonky CG aside, it's actually all right. And then the way that it all ends is because he makes a choice to stop fighting. And then, of course, Smith being a program, well, his purpose is fulfilled. He has no reason to exist, so he just ultimately crashes.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's quite clever as well. Like, that's another way of playing with the archetype of, you know, you've got a villain. What's a villain's purpose? What's to beat the bad guy, the good guy. So what happens when he wins? Well, nothing. Yeah. You know, like, loads and loads of Disney films have shown us that. What happens when the bad guy wins? Well, it all falls apart.
Yes.
he's reached his goal, and then what?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So it's the same kind of thing here, which is, I think, is quite a clever way of inverting that storyline as well on him. I'll tell you one character I'd love to get your insights on, and I think he's probably just as important with Neo, but he does take a bit of a back seat as the films go on, and that's the character of Morpheus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because he's a massive player in the first film, and then obviously once Neo kind of gets his powers and takes his position, Morpheus kind of shrinks back a little bit into the background, but he still has a really important role.
Yeah, no, it is a shame. I think the performance by Lawrence Fishburne in the first is just that might be the best in the film, right? It's so commanding, and that when Neo first meets him in the room when the thunder and lightning is going off, and he's explaining what the Matrix is, just spine tingles when that happens.
Yeah,
but you're right. It's weird. In the second film, he's very much. He's a sort of a true believer in Neo and Neo's power to bring about change and to stop the war from happening before it happens. So he is all about guiding Neo to the source where he can shut off the machines and prevent the war with Zion. But of course, as we've said, the architect business happens and Neo realizes that this thing that was sold to him as his destiny was very much a lie. And he has to then go back into the real world and tell Morpheus, oh man, yeah, everything you believed in, it is not really the case, man. So the thing you've sort of predicated your life on, kind of all for naught. And it's heartbreaking. There's, I think the third film, he's very much a non-entity, isn't he? He kind of sits out an awful lot of that. And it's a real shame because he's a really interesting character and played wonderfully by Lawrence Fishburne. But that is very much, there's a moment at the end of the second film when Neo comes back from his meeting with the architect and he tells Morpheus the truth. Morpheus, it's a really great turn. There's a really subtle note of Morpheus's whole world is crumbling out from beneath him, and it's a man of faith having his faith, like God is essentially killed right in front of him. And it's something like, oh no, it's melodramatic. It's something like, it cannot be, no. And then within, you know, a couple of narrative beats of that, his ship, the Nebuchadnezzar, is blown up by sentinels, and there's a look on his face, his eyes and his cheeks just completely sag as everything he knew to be true and to be this light of hope in the world is extinguished from him. And it's a tragic turn for the character, that this man who gave his life he doesn't die. He not literally gave his life, but he dedicated his life to this greater good. Just having his faith not rewarded, but what's the opposite of rewarded? Punished, I suppose.
And
that doesn't mean, unfortunately, that in the third film he no longer has a purpose, and you know that is a flaw. I would love for him to have had something more to do in the third film instead of sort of lick his wounds and you know and be upset. But I think certainly for the first two films he has a really interesting arc, and it is nice that ultimately by the end of the third film, by the third revolution, he is kind of given some kind of hope. He's able to look at the new dawn and see a new direction for his species. But yeah, it's a real tragic turn for the character that he takes in a second film.
Yeah, totally. I think, yeah, there's that bit, just thinking about that scene you're describing, where he's watching the Nebuchadnezzar get blown up. And I think he says something under his breath, like, you know, I had a dream and now that dream is gone.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that. And it's just such a, like, you just want to give him a hug.
Yeah.
Like, aww. It's okay. But
yeah,
it's a fascinating thing because his character, yeah, represents this entire sort of theme of faith and hope in humanity. And you would think, yeah, if you're living in a post-apocalyptic world, you're going to hang on to like any shred of hope and light that you have. So yeah, to be told that ultimately that was fed to you by essentially the enemy, that would absolutely crush somebody. But as you say, the ray of hope sort of at the end of the third film of realizing that, oh, it didn't work out the way I wanted it to or was expecting it to, but maybe that's for the better. And
yeah,
you know, I think that's a really interesting theme, and as you said, it's carried very well on the shoulders of Lawrence Fishburne as his character. And you know, I think a lot of the others as well. I think Trinity goes through a similar arc as well.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I think that, again, there's probably a bit of contention with her ultimate destination in the stories. She is the one who brings Neo into the world, and she certainly recruits and makes first contact in the first film. And she, I think uncharitably you could say, she has her agency taken away a little bit as the films go along. She's a bit of a damsel in distress in the second when he has to fly and save her. And ultimately, I think we're past the point of saying spoiler alert now, but
oh yeah,
she does ultimately die in the third film, and it's and again, she's not much of an entity in the third film either. But I don't know. I like the performance of Carrie Ann Musters in that film, in all three films. And I suppose on the wider game board of this whole series, that they are all, to a point, pawns of the Oracle. That the Oracle wants to liberate the human race. That's how I read it anyway. You could be a bit more cynical and say this is all part of an even greater cycle of control. But Trinity is very much the recipient of the Oracle's manipulation in kind of being pushed towards loving Neo, which ultimately allows him to become the ultimate one. I don't know. What's your take on her as a character in the sequels?
I do agree. I think her and Morpheus, they do suffer with being sort of pushed into the background a bit, which is a real shame. Because as you say, Carrie Ann Moss is fantastic in the role. And I feel like in the first film in particular, she has a lot of agency, and it's kind of definitely one of the earlier, I think, sort of heroine characters, you know, done really well, where she's more than capable of handling herself in any situation. Mm. And that's kind of nice to see. But I think as well, it's interesting that in order for Neo to kind of get to the point of becoming the one, of reaching his destiny, is that he needs that support.
Yeah.
And that really she's the last piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
I think that's quite empowering in a way. That's kind of nice.
Yeah.
That, you know, and that without her, he's a lost man. He's still a man at the core of it all. I think that's really sweet. I think that's actually quite a nice, and again, it's these different human themes that they sprinkle in for the film. And love is, of course, a really powerful
absolutely.
One.
Absolutely. And it's his love for her that allows him to make that important choice in the second film that essentially frees humanity from this cycle of control with the machine. So yeah, I suppose love conquers all.
Which is cheesy in itself, but that's okay. That's, you know, that's kind of the whole point of the film, isn't it? It's is it better to have everything run by machines and have it all sort of preordained and predestined and everything, or is it better to just experience things in the moment and go along with the human condition? So see, these movies are deep.
And you know what, and like they're cheesy, they're super cheesy, yeah. And they're super earnest, and I love that. I think it's so easy, especially now, it's so easy to sound like an old man yelling at a cloud again. It's so easy to be arch and ironic and kind of hedge your bets and not put your heart on your sleeve just to avoid, you know, because it's not cool, it's embarrassing, whatever. These movies are very, very heart on sleeve. The Wachowskis are very, very heart on sleeve filmmakers, and they really, they paint in these huge, broad emotional strokes. And most of their films do boil down to love and freedom of human expression and, you know, the messy emotions that make us unique and beautiful in our own ways. And I mean, that in itself might put some people off, but I love big, bold swings like that. I love earnestness, and I love genuine, you know, genuine empathy in blockbusters, I suppose, and art in general.
Yeah, no, me too. I've said often on this show, and this is a hill I die on, the whole point of art, and you know, and movies are art.
Yeah,
television,
totally.
Acting is all part of the same big thing, whether it's music, painting, whatever. It's the whole point is to make you feel something. You know, you can tell a story, you can have fun, and sometimes it's to make you laugh, or it's to make you, you know, be in awe of a crazy action scene or whatever. That's fine, feel excitement, but they can go deeper, and that's great. And I like stuff like you said that takes a big swing, yeah, and tries to sort of bring all of that together. And one thing I'm always fascinated with, because I've fallen in love with the whole AI subject anyway, because it just fascinates me, yeah, because at the core of it, it's writers trying to get to what makes you people people. I mean, I'm not one of those people that necessarily believes that we'll ever get a machine to feel the way a human does. I mean, I don't know, Elon Musk might prove me wrong at some point, but I'm watching that guy. But in all seriousness, like, that's a really interesting theme of these movies as well, is this idea that programs and systems, and you've already mentioned really probably the biggest one, the Oracle, kind of goes against convention. So I'd love to hear your insights on her character, because I think she's a fascinating one.
She is the character who makes the decision that kickstarts this whole series of films into motion. And she and the architect are the mother and father of the Matrix. He's very much the cold, analytical, logistical side of things, and to be clear, they're both programs. They're both bits of code within a computer system, which is the Matrix. But she is the kind of the part of the code who is responsible for humans and populating it with humans and understanding humans. And I think her character, I mean, as an aside, the performance in the first film by the actress Gloria Foster, I absolutely adore. The scene in particular when Neo first meets her and she's baking cookies, and it's such a warm, natural, that is the most naturalistic performance in the film. In a film of these wild, over the top Hong Kong cinema style performances, that is such an earthy, really warm performance, and I adore that. Her character is a machine, essentially a program, a part of the Matrix, who I think she in some respects longs to be human, and she's fascinated by humanity and the human condition in a way that the other machines are either unwilling or unable to be. Certainly the architect, he doesn't feel the same. He sees us as batteries, like, you know, the rest of the machines do, whereas she, I think she sees herself as maybe a liberator, maybe someone who doesn't want to see a whole species exploited like the humans are being by that point in the Matrix, but she's someone who feels a deep well of compassion towards the human race, and through her work in trying to understand humans, develops a real sense of kinship to them, I think, and she ultimately pushes events into the place that they are at the start of the first film. And She kind of is the protagonist. You could make that argument, I think, in that she is the one who has the most agency, and that she allows this all to happen. Because one of the final parts of Revolutions is the architect and the oracle meeting on the park bench as the new dawn is coming. And he says something like, it was a risky game you played. And you know, kind of makes it explicit that this is all a risk that she made in an attempt to create a better world for the human beings. And yeah, she's great. She's a really cool character. And it's a, we should say as well that the original actress, Gloria Foster, she did die during production. So unfortunately, she wasn't in the third film. And obviously, you can't fight nature. It's very, very sad. But it was a wonderful performance in the first two films that she gave.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you're right. Like, that's one of my favourite scenes of the first film is when he meets her for the first time, because it's not what you're expecting.
No, it's not.
You know, I almost feel like you, the architect, you're kind of like, oh yeah, this makes sense. he's a weird, creepy dude in a room full of screens. You're like, yeah, that makes sense. That's this tracks. But for the Oracle to be this like sweet sort of grandmotherly kind of figure that just has this sort of knackered old apartment and she's baking cookies and, you know, is, but at the same time is throwing wisdom his way and is like predicting what he's going to do and stuff. Like, it's a very, like you said, it's a really lovely performance, really lovely scene. But it, again, it's, as a character, it fascinates me because I think it gets to the core of it, which is, as you say, this program wanting to understand what humans are and wanting a better thing for them. And that's quite a deep theme in itself as well, this idea of a program can see the bigger picture and go, well, we can do better than this. You know, if we just do the same cycle again, we'll be right back here. You know, and as you said, the other programs are like, yeah, that suits us just fine and dandy. But obviously her character is written in a way to go, well, that's not good for them. I want to give them a better start. So she just throws the spanner in the works and away they go. And I think that's a really interesting character to put in a film and a lovely kind of theme to just sew into this, what otherwise you could write off, as we said earlier, as a big crazy action film.
Yeah,
actually,
absolutely.
It's got a lot of heart in the middle of it. And as you say, yeah, she's absolutely a protagonist.
She just wants to, this cycle that we have ongoing, it's not working. You know, it's destructive and it's excessive and it's wasteful. And on a purely functional level, establishing a new relationship would be surely more efficient and more beneficial. One based on trust and, you know, and love and respect.
Yeah, and I kind of love as well the sequels, as we've already covered really a few bits already, but the sequels go into this idea that, yeah, that this has all happened before, and you know, and you meet other programs like the Merovingian, which is, I think, one of the weirdest characters before. But an interesting little, like, footnote of, you know, oh yeah, there's, you know, this has happened before, and these programs cycle through, and they sort of put new skins on, and they just sort of rebrand themselves, and survive and just sort of do what they have to do in order to keep moving along. I think that's just layers of it that, you know, admittedly you don't need to know too much about it, but it's an interesting note, I think, to kind of go, oh okay, so that happens in this world. And I mean, if you've gone through all the trouble of creating this crazy mythology of the Matrix, you might as well explore some corners of it and sort of say, oh, here's some things that happen and here's the bigger picture and how it all works. So yeah, I think for that reason and many of the others we've discussed, it's, yeah, who knows, maybe somebody listening will be encouraged to go and watch these again.
I do hope so. The Merovingian is one of those people, you know, in Empire Strikes Back when you meet Boba Fett and you meet the lineup of the different bounty hunters and you can just speculate as to what their backstories are, and it's so cool to think about the part of the universe they inhabit. The Merovingian, I think, has a similar function. It's a weird scene, like you say, the orgasm cake scene and the ridiculous, like, almost offensively stereotypical French sort of characteristic, you know, bursting from the screen. But his, like, the idea of what he represents, he's a remnant from a previous version of the Matrix, and he collects. All that defunct programs, and he's kind of like the code version of a criminal overlord, and that kind of allows for things like, you know, vampires and werewolves are in these movies. You might not know it because it doesn't make it obvious, but you know, I just quite like the corners that are teased of this world, and it's not immediately apparent, but it's quite fun. It's like you say, it's quite fun to have that in there. It's a fun little part of it.
It's just extra detail, isn't it? Just to sort of sprinkle in, it kind of fleshes the world out a little bit. I think that's great. And speaking of villains, I mean, I think it would be remiss if we didn't discuss, we've already mentioned him a little bit, but yeah, the Agent Smith. I think probably one of the most instantly recognisable villains that I think in the sequels gets a really interesting twist and sort of return.
Yeah.
That I didn't see coming, I think.
No. He's wonderful, isn't he? I feel like a lot of this conversation is us just saying, oh, this person's wonderful, this person's wonderful. But there are so many wonderful performances in these movies, and he is just having so much fun. His diction in these movies, I absolutely adore. He just chews every word. But he's kind of the evil twin to Neo in some respects. I think when Neo is set off on this new journey as the new one, he inadvertently frees Agent Smith from his constraints as an expression of the machines, and he's able to spread like a virus and permeate eventually in the second film, like you say, permeate the real world and bring about a whole new set of complications. It's really interesting. He hates the Matrix as a character. He's a program who just absolutely despises the thing that he is inextricably a part of. So when he is quote unquote destroyed by Neo in the first film and is actually freed, he becomes this cackling pantomime villain, and it's a hammy performance. And there's that clip of him doing the evil laugh in Revolutions that you can you can take out of context and giggle at. But he's having a bloody great time. He's loving it. He's loving his freedom. And he just wants to destroy this thing that he hates. Yeah, it's an interesting counterpoint to someone like Joe Pantoliano's Cypher in the first film, who it's a real shame that he isn't in the sequels, because I love Joey Pants. He's brilliant. But he's a guy who hates the real world and wants to get plugged back into the safe confines of the Matrix, and Smith is the opposite of that. He's a creature who hates this system that he's an extension of and wants to be something more, which is kind of a protagonist's goal as well. He's given a clear goal that's understandable and could easily be that of a protagonist.
It's very heavily foreshadowed in the first film, especially with that interrogation scene with him and Morpheus. I remember I loved that. I thought that was brilliant, because it was just a sort of like a sprinkling of this character who previously is just one of these suits, quite literally.
Men in Black.
Yeah, doesn't have any personality, and you know, and then all of a sudden, oh no, he's got a personality, he's got a goal, and as you say, it's very clear and apparent, and then in a way, you could almost be forgiven for thinking that you'll never see him again in the sequels. Yeah. He's like, well, he was destroyed, he was defeated. And then he comes back, and suddenly it's like, oh, okay, this is something else. And I mean, again, slightly wonky CG aside, just by today's standards, because CG ages poorly most of the time, that fight scene with Neo and like the 100 or so Smiths, I think it's spectacular. Like, you look at it, it's truly groundbreaking for the time. Like, no one had tried anything like that before. And yeah, it gets a bit cartoony, but it's like, again, as you said earlier, we're in a hyper-realized world. We're in a computer program. Yeah, have some fun. Break some physics. Do some weird stuff with a pole that you pull out of the ground. Like, why not? You know, why not have some fun with it?
Yeah. No, it's very, very cool. And I know that a lot is made, on that point, a lot is made about the innovations introduced to allow for bullet time in the first film, and there's a lot spoken about how they achieve the effect of when Neo is dodging the bullets and leaning backwards and the camera kind of pivots around him at a normal pace, but just with the action around it slowed down. That's obviously an incredible, hugely influential effect. But you know, there was stuff done in the sequels, while slightly more dated on the face of it, the technology introduced to allow for that, the scene, the burly brawl that you're talking about, this thing, Universal Capture, it was called, developed by George Borshchikov by ESC, which is a CGI wing developed by Warner Brothers to investigate these, to investigate the technologies required to do what the Wachowskis had in mind for the sequels. Because, of course, you know, with the sequel, you've got to top what the original does. So, you know, they couldn't have used the bullet time technology for that fight or the fight at the end of Revolutions or any of those things. So they invented this thing, Universal Capture, which allowed... It's not the same as motion capture. It's a different form of mapping the actors' faces and bringing to life these fake environments. But it's a little bit rough to the modern eye, I suppose. But what it's going for is, yeah, it's hugely ambitious for the time, definitely. And it's quite speaks a lot to their ambition as filmmakers and VFX artists that they wanted to push the envelope so much.
Yeah, and I mean, bear in mind they're blending really high octane, crazy kind of action as well. I mean, as you said earlier, that a lot of the cast all went through crazy amounts of training, and they brought on the best people they could for it. So to do that with a blend, I just as you were talking about the effects, just one scene that flashed in my head. It's very minor, but I think it's brilliant. Is when the weird twins.
The ghosts
first show up, and you don't quite know what their deal is, and then I think it's as they're fighting, it might have been Trinity or one of them, and I think she's got like a switchblade and she's just like trying to fend them off, and as she's doing that, like, there's bits where they're jumping around and then they just sort of, they would switch in and out of being themselves and then kind of being that weird ghosty thing, so stuff will just go right through them. I mean, that's incredible. Like, I think just to blend that kind of crazy action and then effects in it.
Yeah.
I think looking back on it, it looks, I think, pretty seamless for the most part. Like, it's, you know, and then it leads into, as we said earlier, one of like the greatest, I would argue, one of the greatest action sequences ever, which is the freeway chase.
Yeah, completely
agree. I mean, let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, again, they built a freeway.
1.5 miles, I think it was. I've got it noted down somewhere. Yeah, 1.5 mile freeway. Yeah, it is incredible, isn't it? And that is something, I think, as much as they do push the envelope with digital effects, they do an awful lot practical, and I think they do as much practically as they can for a story like this. I think I will concede that the opening half an hour or so, maybe even the first act of Reloaded, is a bit rough as you recalibrate to what the film is doing. But as soon as they meet the Merovingian, and then as soon as that conversation is finished, it is pretty much balls to the wall action for the next hour or so. And it is some of the most well-realized, lucid, beautifully done stuff. Like, you've got the fight in the foyer of the Merovingian's mansion, which leads into the freeway chase, which culminates in... It incorporates hand-to-hand combat and gunfights and sword fights and all sorts of business, and it's so exciting. It is, yeah. It's, I think I would agree. It's one of the all-time set pieces.
Yeah, and it's like, and it blends as well with the characters. It really ups stakes because, you know, they're suddenly up against a whole host of villains. They've got the sort of criminals, as you say. Some of them are weird, glitchy programs. You don't know what they can do with like sort of supernatural powers, and then you've got the agents, which themselves are kind of super strong and fast. And so it's like, yeah, the whole time it's really tense because you're just watching it and you're just like, they are heavily outmatched here. And it's just a case of they're just trying to run out the clock until either Neo shows up, you know, or they can get to a phone or whatever. And I think it kind of harkens back to that part of the first film, which was, you know, when an agent showed up, they were like, nope, run, you know, just get out of there. And it's really tense. So I thought it was quite a nice way of sort of upping the ante, but also taking you back into that first one a little bit.
Yeah, it's that sense of menace, which I think the back half of the first Matrix, like you say, with the agents and with the threat that they pose, is a real sense of menace to them. And it gives a weight to the set pieces that I think some of the set pieces in the sequels don't have. But the reason the freeway chase, like you say, is so effective is because it brings back that sense of menace. It's got all these unfamiliar elements, the ghosts, the agents, even the freeway itself, they've set up earlier on, never go on the freeway. It's suicide, basically. So you have, you know, that the implications of what could the freeway bring they're trapped without access to a phone for as long as they are, and, you know, so you're really taken away from the safety zone and you're put into this arena of palpable danger, and it makes it so much more exciting when you feel the stakes on a human level like that. It's very, very cool.
It is, isn't it? And do you know what, I even think back on the third film, like, I think it's tough because it does miss the element that we all love, which is The Matrix. You know, that's largely removed from most of the films, so I can understand that. But then if you're following the journey, as you sort of, as very well explained throughout, then it does at least answer some questions, and it gives you an ending, and I think it's quite satisfying in that respect.
Definitely,
and, yeah, you know, even the War on Zion I thought was pretty well done. There's some really cool designs, yeah, and stuff that James Cameron definitely didn't rip off for Avatar. No, that's in there.
There's a give and take, though. There's a give and take. I mean, it stays like a fair bit from Aliens. And but again, speaking of menace, the War on Zion is really bloody, and I think it has a real weight to it. And yeah, the designs are absolutely stunning. The amount, I think that is probably, that's a perfect synthesis of CGI and physical sets and physical action. And I find it very exciting. I've heard some folks call it too video gamey and just a bit too drab, I suppose. But I just think it's a really good war movie, and it really works as a sort of last stand. And I think by that point, if you're on board, you have that emotional investment in what this represents for the human race. And certainly when I was watching it earlier in lockdown, I'd seen it before many, many times, of course, but I was really, really caught up in the emotional crescendo that the Siege of Zion, you know, represents. It's great. I mean, we can talk about the philosophical undertones and the emotions, but just as a pure piece of spectacle filmmaking, it's so cool. It's really cool.
Yeah. I always say that to people as well, even if you don't get the rest of it underneath, which is fine. Yeah, just enjoy it for what it is. It's a crazy action film with, so like you said, some incredibly unique aesthetics and things that you will never see again. And you know, and not everyone's going to appreciate it. I will mention this because I know she listens. but I took my wife to see the 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
And bless her heart, I don't think she realized how long it was. She maintains that she enjoyed bits of it, but then, like, when she found out there was like another 45 minutes to go, she was like, not happy. That's on me. I should have brought more snacks. But
so, yeah,
I have got the sequels. I've got the whole box set in the DVD cabinet, and I'm like, yeah, I need to crack it out and soon and watch it. And yeah, after my chat with Andy on here, like, I've now got all the Rocky films lined up Prime, so it's like I've got a lot of watching to do now.
Oh, me too. I listened to that discussion. Great conversation, by the way, the Rocky one, and I'm really hankering to rewatch those as well. You guys did a great job.
Oh man, thanks. He's your co-host.
He's the best. Yeah, he's wonderful. My pod partner.
I will say, at the time of recording as well, you guys just put out a tweet for your ET episode, which I've got downloaded to listen to tomorrow. But that picture you guys put up, I just head over to @RamblinAmblin or @Fundamentals, because either one of us will just tweet it. It's hilarious.
I should say,
I'm not going to say what it is, because I want people to go and see it for themselves. It's incredible.
A former colleague of ours, a fellow called Steve Riley, he's the one who made that. He's very insistent on making that, so I should give him a shout out for doing that. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. That made my day. It was amazing. I just want to ask then, so what's the news on the sequels? Because I actually don't know an awful lot, other than Keanu Reeves is apparently returning for a fourth film.
Yeah.
And I've heard drips and drabs of potentially other people being involved. But
yeah, I mean,
it's very hush-hush.
It's very hush-hush. And I think I do quite miss the drip feeding of him. I kind of miss going into a film blind. I'd love to recapture the feeling of watching the first film, knowing so little about it. So I've not been that plugged into this, but I did do a little bit of looking around ahead of this, and it's on track for a release this year, the 21st of December. It had a lot. It was pushed back to next year, then it was brought forward again. It's going to be released in cinemas and on HBO Max at the end of the year. There's no information about the story at all. All we know is that, Neo is back and Trinity is back. So funnily enough, the two characters that are definitively dead by the end of the third one are back. Lawrence Fishburne, I don't think he was approached to be in it. So Morpheus, as we know him from the third film, is not in it. But there were at one point rumours that there was going to be a younger version of Morpheus. And Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who was so good in Chicago 7 as Bobby Seale earlier in this year.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Yeah, incredible.
I think the rumours are that he's playing a younger version of Morpheus. So I don't quite know what that would entail. What I do love is that Jada Pinkett Smith is back as Niobe. I love Jada Pinkett Smith. I love seeing her in things. And she so rarely does film roles these days too. So it's nice to see that she's back. Our boy, the Merovingian's back as well. He's on the cast list. And weirdly enough, I know Hugo Weaving for a long time was down to be in a potential fourth film as long as the Wachowskis were returning. I don't think he could make the schedule work, so he's not going to be in it. But Daniel Bernhardt, who played Agent Johnson, who is one of the other agents in the original trilogy, he's back for this one as well. So that's quite interesting. And then you've got some interesting folks in the supporting cast. You've got Neil Patrick Harris is there as well. Priyanka Chopra is there, who was in The White Tiger, which was released on Netflix last week, which is very, very good if you get a chance to watch that.
Okay.
I'm not on the payroll. I just it's a recommendation. but yeah, no, so that's kind of all we know. That there was rumours of a reboot about 4 or 5 years ago. It's not a reboot because the Wachowskis, well, not both of the Wachowskis, it is just Lana returning for this one. Writing and directing and producing. I think Lily is working on a TV series, and so just sort of handed the reins to her sister for this one. So yeah, it's curious. I know originally they were dead against making any more after Revolutions. They saw it as a trilogy. That was the end of the story. But you know, if at least half of the Wachowskis is back for this, then I have faith. You know, there's no reason to doubt them yet. I'm a defender of Jupiter Ascending, so I'll see anything that they bring out. Oh, wow.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So we'll watch this space. I think filming began February last year, then it obviously was put on hiatus for lockdown, then it resumed, I think, late last year, maybe even late summer last year. I'm not sure if they're filming still or if they've wrapped or if they've postponed again, but yeah, the most recent release date is December this year. So watch this space.
I will, yeah. I'm very curious about it, as you say, especially with that cast and some potential returning. It does kind of make you sort of go, okay, all right. Because, yeah, as we've established, really, that it works well as a trilogy. Some story kind of ties itself up nicely. So, yeah, who knows where it goes? We'll keep an eye on that. But is there anything else then, Josh, that you'd love to kind of dive into on this series?
In terms of diving into, I think we've covered the main areas. Something else I did want to bring up was that when the sequels were announced, it was not just a part two and a part three, but it was a whole extended multimedia universe. And I know we've had, obviously, the Star Wars EU has a whole host of tie-in stories, and the MCU has a whole, pretty much any IP has multimedia tie-ins. But I think what the Matrix universe did was everything fed into everything else. So there are parts of the Matrix Reloaded that kind of make more sense if you play the video game Enter the Matrix, which do you play Enter the Matrix?
I remember that game.
I mean, it wasn't good, don't get me wrong. It was buggy and it was really counterintuitive. But you play as Niobe and Ghost in that game. So they're not a huge presence in the films themselves, but there's a load of footage that the Wachowskis filmed for that video game. And it does give... Because there were points when Jada Pinkett Smith has said that she wasn't sure if she was filming something for the movie or for the game. And and then I've got, beyond that, you've got The Animatrix, which I didn't get a chance to revisit ahead of this, but really, really, really recommend watching those. If you're a slightly curious listener and are tempted to delve into this world, just give one of those a go. You've got a two-part prequel anime called The Second Renaissance, which kind of shows how the Matrix came to be, how the machines took over and how the Matrix came to be. You've got some really cool black and white noir stories in there. You've got some awesome, at the time, cutting-edge CGI dojo fighting animations. It's really, really cool. Really cool. But I think basically the Wachowskis gave animators from around the world pretty much free reign to do whatever they wanted within the confines of the Matrix universe. And that's very, very cool. There's some really interesting stuff going on in those films, and I would highly recommend seeking those out. They are part of the Matrix box set, which I mentioned previously as well. It's one of the 10 discs.
Oh, wow. Okay. I haven't quite got that. I think I've just got the standard trilogy.
Have you seen the Animatrix? Have you seen any of the Animatrix films?
I think I've seen one or two of them. It does ring a bell, like particularly the sort of origins of it. Because I thought that was quite a curious story. And,
And
how they pieced that together was quite good. I haven't seen them for years, but yeah, you're right. I remember the video game as well. I think one or two of my mates at school had it.
Yeah.
And I remember sort of checking it out. And as you say, going, oh, there's scenes from characters in this, and you're like, oh, that's actually quite cool. That's quite a unique concept. I don't think many movies necessarily do as much, apart from, as you say, like probably MCU Star Wars, but that's more in like TV series as opposed to other stuff. You know, it's usually very separate, isn't it, what comes
out. It's not essential. It's just kind of supplementary material, whereas this kind of, again, it's not really essential, but it does add important context if you want it. I mean, The Final Flight of the Osiris, one of the Animatrix films, leads directly into the second movie. And then Enter the Matrix happens alongside the second film as well. So at the end of the freeway chase, Morpheus falls off the truck that he's fighting on top of, and he lands on the car of Niobe and Ghost. And in the video game, you drive the car and you catch Morpheus. So it's kind of cool jigsaw storytelling.
Yeah, so if you've ever watched that and you think, oh yeah, whatever happened to Jada Pinkett Smith's character during the film?
Yes.
She's in a video game. That's your answer. Brilliant. But Josh, I think that's amazing. Thank you so much for coming on and just talking to me about this stuff. So for the good people listening, where can they find you?
If you want, you can follow me on Twitter at Josh_Glenn. You don't need to do that. I don't really tweet an awful lot. But what I would recommend is to follow Ramblin' Amblin', which is a podcast that myself and your former guest, Mr. Andrew Gurdion, host. And we're working through the films in the Amblin' filmography. Like you say, we just released our E.T. episode, which one of us got very emotional talking about. I'll let you decide who that might have been. we're recording Gremlins next, which is I'm very excited to rewatch. That's
love that film.
Me too, man. Me too. So join us for the journey.
Yeah, well, I'm to say I'm definitely subscribed, and I think I've plugged it before, but I'll plug it again. It's well worth checking out, guys. It's incredible filmography that you guys have gone through.
Good stuff.
You've got quite the journey ahead of you.
We'll have you on, of course.
Yeah, I think Andy said I am on at some point. I don't want to spoil just yet which one that is, but I will be plugging it as soon as it comes out. But yeah, other than that, Josh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me and allowing me to talk about the Matrix films, because not many people do.
Anytime. And there we have it. Thank you so much, Joshua, for coming onto the show and talking to me about all things The Matrix. That was a truly brilliant conversation. I hope you guys listening enjoyed it just as much as I did and got all of the amazing insights that Joshua brought to the table. If you want to hear more from him and more insights like this, which of course you want to, then head over to Ramblin' and Amblin' podcast, where he and previous guest Andrew Gurdion go through all of the movies under the Amblin' production banner. It's a truly spectacular podcast with an amazing list of films that they are working their way through. Also, be sure to go and check out Josh on Twitter. I've linked that into the episode description, so you can go and find him there as well. I should point out that the obviously at the time of recording was a few weeks back. They've done a few more episodes since, but the ET episode is absolutely brilliant, and I've even linked in the specific tweet that has the picture in it. Again, I'm not going to spoil it because it's hilarious. You just need to go and see it, and you need to follow at Ramblin' Amblin' as well on Twitter, because those guys just come up with not only great content but hilarious podcast introductions as well. If you are enjoying this podcast, then by all means, make sure you follow me on both Instagram and Twitter at FundamentalsPod. Say hello. Any feedback you've given me will be greatly appreciated. And if you're kind enough to go and leave me a nice review on your chosen app of choice, 5 stars preferably, then definitely tell me if I miss it, because you will have earned a shout out on the pod. That's enough for me. That's enough shameful plugging. I'll be back again in a few weeks' time with a completely different guest on a completely different subject. So until then, stay tuned and stay safe.